This is Storycatcher with Patricia Glynn. Welcome to Inspirations, stories that go deeper with people who go further. We're stepping into the world of Southern Africans who are truly exceptional. And because they're living big and asking the big questions, our conversations here are longer than those on Potpourri. This month's guest is a bushman, a man of the bush. You know one when you meet one. They have very little time for BS, they don't talk much, and they sum you up in a very direct way. Not ill-mannered, just considered. Having read Konrad de Rosner's wonderful book, Called by the Wild, it was clear to me that he was a true bushman. And given that, I decided that I should spend some time with him before I put a microphone between us. So I went to his farm outside Hoedspruit, and I was indeed summed up. Not only by Konrad, but by his 9 pretty intimidating dogs. It soon became clear that I wouldn't have a problem getting him to talk. He's an enthusiastic man and showed me around the stone house that he and his wife Anka have built with great love and some eccentricity. I must have passed the admissions test because a few weeks later I was back at Konrad's place with my friend Mish Cochran, taxi driver, host, fixer, and a whole lot else during my 3rd visit to Hoedspruit. Long backstory there, which I'll talk about in the Potpourri collection. We were mobbed at the gate by a jostling melee of bloodhound, Weimaraner and Afrikaners, and Konrad showed us through the wire the hand gestures we needed to use to control the hounds, lest they, you know, start fighting with each other in their excitement at welcoming us. They sort of worked, the hand signals. I love the fact that even though they're working dogs, they live in the house with Konrad and Anka. There are 2 extra-large settees in the sitting room which are used by hounds and humans alike, and I noticed one very old dog shuffling around with the rest. When they stop working, Konrad tells me, the dogs live out their days with him. In many security setups, they're put down, I must tell you. By this time, I'm totally fan-struck, of course, and quite happy for our recording to be accompanied by panting, petting, scrapping and thumping, which I hope you'll forgive, as I hope you'll forgive dear Blitzy's panting. Although Konrad has made a huge contribution in the fight against rhino poaching, he's now predominantly facing down the scourge of bushmeat poaching, which is much, much more prevalent and involves syndicates which are just as powerful and dangerous as the ones that are after the rhino. It's a violent business, so if you're squeamish, you might not be able to handle what Con talks about. Please be warned about that. As he puts it, we might live in paradise, but at times we deal with hell. His book goes into far more detail about the hell that he and his fellow wildlife warriors face, but it is shocking, and it is ramping up with every passing month. Nonetheless, Canine Conservation, the unit Konrad founded, still has a good arrest record, and they wouldn't have it were it not for the dogs.
And Mzimbi is doing well against the snaring, you know, where the poachers are setting all the snares. Because he used to work with the poachers that were setting snares in the field. And when we got him, we just had to change him to become our ally instead of the poachers' ally.
Well, you say in the book that one of the things you're facing is that the poachers are now mimicking your training, your dogs. So how are you dealing with that?
Yeah, we found this out actually relatively recently. The poachers have started training their canines to attack our rangers. And a lot of the work that we're doing is at nighttime. And the poachers will come in with a pack of their hunting dogs, or Canis Africanuses. And they will then go and hunt along the fences. They'll walk up and down fences of various different game reserves. And then the dogs chase the animals into the fence. And when the animal gets stuck in the fence and starts bleating, then the poachers run up and dispatch it. Then, obviously, we can hear this. Our rangers hear this out in the field. And we go running towards where that is happening and to try and apprehend the poachers. Then what happens is that their pack of dogs goes for our rangers. And if our ranger has a dog that pack of dog focuses in on our one dog. And it's just like a hell of a fight over there. Then the one incident, the actual poacher himself, whilst the dogs were trying to attack one of the rangers, the poacher himself ran up to go and stick his axe in one of our rangers' heads. And one of the other rangers, the backup ranger, he put a bullet through the guy's leg.
Oh, what a pity. Only the leg?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are not out there to kill people. We are out there to preserve and also, you know, respect life. So,
would you not, I'm afraid, tragically, have to kill all the dogs, the poachers' dogs that you find?
So, because those dogs were so aggressive and they were actively trying to attack our rangers, the rangers did destroy a part of that pack. And the next day, some of the other dogs were running around and they were euthanized, put it that way. And also what happens is that there's a whole lot of legislation in South Africa which is protecting these packs of hunting dogs. You can't just go out and shoot a dog. In certain provinces, it's actually illegal to do that. It needs to be processed and handled by the SPCA, and the animals will be put down in a humane way, you know, with injections, etc. However, if the dog is attacking one of our rangers, the ranger or myself, and the dog is coming for me, I've had it a few times in my life, and I even, at one stage, I'll tell you the story about the rabies positive dog. Then they will act in self-defense. And then that ends up, you know, it's a really nasty business. Even having to shoot a dog is not nice at all. It's a horrible thing to do. I mean, I'm a dog lover. I love canines. Having to put a bullet in one is a real sad story. I wrote about it in the book in the Kruger National Park, where the one day I was walking down a drainage line with a whole bunch of international students behind me. And so this dog, which was rabies positive, jumped up and came bolting it straight towards us. It was quite a narrow drainage line. And Zingela was in front of me. And Zingela, of course, now took off towards
us. Just explain, Zingela was your beloved dog from
the
past.
Yes, yeah. Zingela actually started canine conservation.
Vimarana.
Yeah, Zingela was an amazing, amazing canine. And I had to aim in a really small gap in between Zingela and the dog that was coming. And Zingela was just about to make contact with that dog. And I had to snap off a shot right past Zingela's ear. Got the dog. And you know, if it's a rabies positive dog, you have to shoot it in the body because you have to then take the head off that dog and send it off to Onderstepoort, where they take a sample and you detect rabies in that dog from a brain sample.
The Vimaranas that Conrad favours as tracking dogs are a 300-year-old breed which have astounding tracking abilities, but having had all that time facing down things like wild boar and European stags, they can be as aggressive as is required of them. The book contains several accounts of how Zingela saved Conrad's life. In fact, the book is dedicated to this outstanding dog, whose death I suspect Conrad has never really got over, despite the fact that he now works with one of Zingela's pups, Lunda. And it was Zingela who inspired the founding of Canine Conservation, Conrad's company. And he founded that in 2012 with four people, two Vimaranas and one Malinois. It is now a highly regarded training facility for tracking and anti-poaching dogs. The book came about because of Conrad's mother, Elaine's, determination that we should hear his story, a story that she describes as a struggle to pay his dues to Africa, a rite of passage to reach the present day where his contribution to conservation has made a small difference. Her source material was what Conrad had documented himself over many years. This book, as I understand it, would not have been possible had you not been an avid diary keeper, writer of a journal, yeah?
Yes, correct.
And it seems to me that journal would reflect how you've changed over the years since you started this work to where you are now. How would you describe that change?
Okay, so there's a whole cupboard full of diaries. And summers and winters come and go very fast. And, you know, dealing with conservation and being out there in the field and running around either protecting animals or doing game walks or game drives for visiting guests, I've gone through a whole sort of change. And my career started in 1991 where I was an apprentice on a game reserve. Then it moved through to guiding at Mteta Musha or Bongani Mountain Lodge for 12 years, and then it morphed into the Rock Art Research Project, and then it went into the Kruger, and I went back over all the diaries and went over all the stories in that. Many of the stories are repetitive because we've been dealing with bushmeat perching for years and years. I mean, I'm now 35 years in the field.
Wow.
And experience, there's nothing to substitute experience. And some people last, some people don't last. Some people can cut it and other people can't. It's a really emotionally distraught kind of work. We deal with a lot of death, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And we deal against that because we are the ones trying to keep the balance out there. And I think there's a very fine line between how a person keeps that balance. If you approach something with aggression and anger, you're going to get a negative outcome. Whereas if you approach it with a more balanced perspective without letting your emotions get away with you, then there will be a better outcome.
But you see a line of snares, and in it are a line of bookies, each thrashing, suffering, crying. How can you not feel anger about that?
Of course I feel anger about it. But when I'm dealing with removing the snares off those animals and freeing them from the snare device or the trap, I feel a sense of accomplishment having released that animal from the snare and is still alive. If the animal is too far gone and too far injured, obviously the animal needs to be put down. And that is like, so I would say a mixture of anger, sadness, regret for the animal having suffered. I would say a mix of emotions, so no one specific emotion, but having done this for so long, it's not that it's become normalized. It's because I've become extremely experienced at dealing with this kind of situation.
You see, you describe it as keeping a balance.
Yes.
That implies a kind of resignation to the fact that you're never going to triumph over it. All you're trying to do is limit it.
Okay, the way I refer to keeping a balance, that's sort of like a more recent term that I've been using, is because you will never stop this bushmeat poaching thing. As I was saying to other people the other day, is that it's your gardener that is working at your house, that in the strip of bush at the back outside the fence line, you go walk in there and you'll probably find snares. And this is everywhere, all over South Africa, from the southern tip of the Cape Point all the way up to Musina. Wires and cables are all over the place. I mean, we are pulling between 400 to 700 snares out of the field every month, every 4 weeks. And we are...
And that's just in the Hoedspruit area.
That's just in 45,000 hectares of this one section that we are contracted to many of the properties in that block. And most of the properties in that block. And this is where we're pulling out this amount of wire from. So the poachers will actually just go and take the farmer's electrical strand wires. And then use the farmer's wire to kill the farmer's animals. And there's a huge bushmeat trade going on. You know, prices of meat have gone up. And there's a lot of people out there which don't have work. And their jobs are to supply meat to the poor people in the villages who don't have work.
And so it's a kind of syndicate?
Very much. It's become very much syndicate-driven and operated. And what has really exacerbated the whole situation is the Zama Zama miners, because they now have money to buy meat. So they're taking orders. So as a result of the Zama Zama miners in the mines in Gravelot and up in Pilgrim's Rest and around, they say that there are over 3,000 Zama Zamas around Pilgrim's Rest. Pilgrim's Rest population is not even 1,000 people. And Gravelot, that whole mountain range there, is a whole bunch of Zama Zamas. The police don't even go up there. Often they conflict with each other. If they kill someone, they just drag the body down and leave it next to the dirt road in the Harmony block. And the police pick it up and take it away. They don't even go in there.
Are there any no-go areas for you?
Yes, up there.
Apart from that.
No, pretty much no. If we go into an area where there might be a conflict scenario or into a village, we go in numbers with backup.
What's numbers? How many?
Anything from 10 to 20 guys.
I'm interested in the fact that when I asked you how you've changed over the years, you didn't mention how your instincts have been honed to the point where they are almost beyond understanding. Is that correct? That
once again, this situation is due to experience and repetitive engaging in the same thing over and over again. And obviously what's going to happen is that if you're working and you're out in the bush for 4 years at nighttime, your senses are going to become highly tuned and heightened because you have to. You can't see with your eyes that well. You know, most people in the daytime, they rely heavily on their eyes. But at nighttime, you've got to go with your nose, your ears, the sounds that you're hearing, or using all your different senses. You're not walking around shining a torch or anything like that. Yes, we've got thermal night and night vision goggles, but you can't wear those all the time.
Why not?
You can't like walk with them on the whole time. It's going to mess with your eyes.
Okay. Yeah. And then, of course, in that situation, sitting in the dark waiting for a poacher or 5 or 10, you're relying also heavily on your dog.
Yes, absolutely. And so that is why the canines or the service dogs or working dogs for us was a major game changer in terms of the successes that we were having. And also having a partnership and working with a canine out in the field, their senses are much more heightened than ours are, especially their scent and their hearing is very acute. So that partnership between man and dog, like what happened with Zingela, the Weimaraner, that I worked with for many years, is actually a vital part of the work that we are doing. Without the canines, we would be several steps back. And it took us many, many years to actually develop the right sort of collection of techniques to implement that in our training of the up-and-coming new dogs that we started working with. We had to learn by trial and error in the beginning. It took quite a few years to get the necessary, keys for the right lock, you know, the right key for the right lock, to unlock and access a greater success rate. And that has taken a long time. And going back into the diary thing, over the years, you can actually see it in the diaries, how working with the canine changed, because I was noting quite a lot of things about what Zingela was doing. And then after Zingela, I've got Zingela's son, Landa. And it was just, and it's been an amazing journey. And now we've got 9 dogs at the house here sitting right around me. And they are living as a pack together. Yes, there will be a scrap and a fight. You know, if one dog is too aggressive, they have to be, they're still in a large run around the house, but just not with the whole pack. And I still think dogs are the best alarm system, because you try and get into this house at night and there's 9 dogs here.
And you mentioned in the book that the dogs teach each other.
Yes. So when we bring in a young puppy, the older dogs who are experienced and who we've trained, in fact, we are now on about generation 4 of the older dogs training the younger dogs. And it makes life, as living in a pack with the dogs, makes life so much easier for us, for the dogs to learn in that way. There can be bad habits that the puppies will learn, but obviously we just have to keep an eye on that. But they are, for the most part, the social skills are vitally important. And when the older dogs are putting their noses down, the young puppy's like, oh, what's that? What's going on over here? Mm. And so we lay a track, and the older dogs are then tracking the human, and even off lead. So the whole pack runs. The young puppies follow, and then it just becomes so easy for us, and it's so quick.
But is it not so that some dogs are better at human tracking and other dogs at rhino tracking and so forth?
Yes, absolutely. Rhino tracking, for the most part, we are working with canines for rhinos. Those dogs are working as a single dog. And we will obviously not divulge too much information about that. But yes, so for example, hashtag my Doberman cross bloodhound, they're called DBs. They were bred by the South African police force to have a bloodhound with a Doberman's bite. So hashtag my Doberman bloodhound, being a 50% bloodhound and 50% Doberman, has got an extremely good nose on him. So from a puppy, all I did was man tracking with him, and he's a natural at it. You know, you can't actually teach a dog how to follow a human scent. They already know how to do it. They're born with that ability. You just have to channel it, the dog's natural ability, in the right direction. So I just encouraged him every time he would be tracking humans. And he's actually a patrol dog, and he's off lead. He's walking up in front of me when I'm out in the bush. I've in fact got 2 dogs. I've got Kalandra, a blue Weimaraner, and hashtag, which I work out in the field with. And both of those dogs are up in front of me, and they're zigzagging across in front of me. They're pointing out every single thing of interest to me, including like with the poachers dogs that we are using. They know exactly how the poachers operate, so they just follow the poachers' trails, and they show us all the different camps where the poachers are camping out in the field. It's just, and where the snares are, old bones or fresh blood, anything like that. The dogs are one of our main tools that we are using to aid and assist us out there in the field, because the dogs are showing you a whole different scent world, of which most people are oblivious to.
Yeah. And it's your obligation to them to keep them alive, because they're going into AK-47s now and that kind of armory. But can you tell us, and by the way, How can you call a beautiful dog like this? Hashtag.
Hashtag. So our dogs earn their names. From a puppy, the dog will earn its name. So in the first month or month and a half, until the dog has earned its name, it won't have a name. We'll say puppy or doggy, come here, you know. And then once the dog identifies what its name is when it will earn its name. So Hashtag was so off the charts and such a weirdo that I didn't know, even know what to call him. So I was just like, okay, Hashtag.
Yeah. On how many occasions would you say they've saved your life?
Sure.
Or maybe just give us an example.
I didn't count, but on countless times. I'll give you a very good example. So walking down on the Olifants River and you're approaching some thick reeds and the dog stops 10 meters from the reeds and is intensively looking and sniffing or head snap, what we call head snapping, or scenting in that direction. The logical conclusion is back out and go around. And 9 times out of 10, it's either a hippo or a buffalo or something like that. So by reading the dog's body language, okay, there's something up ahead there. So we're looking for now for the signs. So if there's red-billed oxpeckers flying up, you know it's a buffalo. If there's lots of flies, little midgy flies, it's a hippo. And also, depending between summer and winter, there could may or may not be flies. Or the red-billed oxpeckers may or may not be on that buffalo. But we're looking for the confirming other indicators.
The book describes some interactions that Conrad has had with wild animals that some would regard as spiritual or extrasensory. This is not the place to describe them, but they make for surprising reading, given that they come from a man whose daily life involves firefights and stakeouts, spies, or impimpis as we call them here in South Africa, tactics and counter-tactics. Both he and Anka have faced death threats and failed hits, and that's why they are constantly assessing who to trust and who not. Have your dogs told you who they don't like and who you shouldn't like?
Yes. There was one specific sergeant that we had working for us who is no longer working for us. And in Simbi, our purchase dog, had an absolute hatred for this guy. And Simbi is a very good character teller. He's one of the best character tellers in Simbi, the purchase dog. And also Victor the Weimar runner, he's very good at that. He can tell immediately if that person is a positive or a negative person. But in Simbi is our best character, judge of character.
And you say she's a poacher dog.
He's a poacher's dog. He's the one that came from the poacher that was shot through the leg. What happened was is when all of this happened, Anka responded, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, to go to where the rangers had shot this poacher. And when she got there, Simbi, who was part of the poacher's dog pack, went to Anka and wouldn't leave her side. So she came back the next morning with Simbi, and I was like, what are you doing bringing the poacher's dog back here? She's like, no, the dog sought a political refugee status. So it's with me now. So that's how Simbi.
It needs to be said that Simbi's just come over and asked for some affection from me. So I know that I'm okay. Hey, Simbi, I'm okay. And I've got...
A nice panting.
I've had a lot of these... Aboriginal Africanus or Aboriginal African dogs in my life.
He's a very nice dog, this guy. Look at him and his character, hey?
Yes.
No,
they have.
You are so naughty.
They have. Yeah. And they're usually very chilled, but not
actually,
when you live
really
in there.
Actually, he's not really naughty at all. Yeah, both the poacher's dogs there. And Julani, the other poacher's dog, he just gets very jealous when I'm giving Simbi attention. But he's a real character, this guy. When we first got him, he was darted in Hoedspruit by Debbie from Proves. He escaped from poachers, Julani, this guy, and he went running on walkabout, and he ended up in Hoedspruit, and he ended up living in a vacant plot of land in the middle of town. And so no one could get anywhere close to him. So Anka and myself, we were driving in town in Hoedspruit, and we saw a dart gun barrel come out of Debbie's car, and she was about 150 meters ahead of us at one of the crossings in Hoedspruit. And so we drove up there and we helped her, and she darted the dog. And then Debbie said, look, I've got no choice. I either have to put this dog down. After the dog was darted and sedated and taken back to the vets, there was a full checkup done. And Julani was terrified of human beings. So Debbie said, look, you know, I've got no choice. If no one's going to take this canine, then I'm going to have to put him down, euthanize him. So an advert went out to the whole of Hoedspruit and surrounds it. No one wanted to take Julani, so that's why he ended up with us.
I was interested that when they're darting animals, that you dip the back of the dart in Dettol.
Yes.
So that your dogs can find which animal has been darted.
Yes. The technique of putting the back of the dart, dipping it in Savlon or Dettol, because they're both very powerful scents. So what happens, that's normally when there's a herd of, say for example, a herd of Inyala, and you need to dart one animal in that herd. What happens is once you dart one animal, the whole herd of Inyalas bombshell and run away. We then trained, that was mainly with Zingela and Landa, the two Weimaraners, my first two Weimaraners, that the dog is then imprinted to track and follow the Dettol scent. And it's just so easy because the scent is so strong. And that's how we were able then to attract one specific animal that had been darted inside the whole herd was purely because of the Dettol scent. It works exceptionally well.
Word is out there that we've lost the battle against rhino poaching. Would you agree with that?
So, look, there are certain protected areas where, yes, most certainly the battle was lost from within.
What do you mean from within?
From within. It was corruption and bad eggs inside the organization that was the cause of the demise of that population of rhinos. So a lot of internal corruption, and the actual people who were employed to protect that area, many of them were involved in the slaughter of those rhinos on that property. And a lot of times there will be internal involvement. Even with the bushmeat poaching thing, we've had corrupt rangers come through the ranks before. We have to identify them and get rid of them. When I say get rid of them, fire them, and then make sure that they don't get employed again by someone else. In certain places, the battle is critical. I'll give you an example. The Kruger National Park have lost most of their rhinos. A massive population of thousands of rhinos is now being dwindled down to maybe, what, a couple of thousand. So there's another protected area up north of us where we are now, in an area called the Harmony Block, which is being heavily targeted by rhino poachers. And in fact, we are on number 15 rhino poachers that my company, in joint operations with certain other units, have arrested this year, 15 rhino poachers. The problem is with this whole thing, and the reason why is because there is no deterrence. And without any deterrence, what happens is these rhino poachers are making big money. The three rhino poachers we arrested four weeks ago made R1 million in 1 month on poaching rhinos. We intercepted and arrested these guys with their rifle in their vehicle. And there were no horns in the vehicle because they were on their way to go and poach. They went to court out on R2,000 bail each. They are Mozambican citizens. They're not even citizens of this country. And the court releases them as illegal international immigrants back into South Africa on R2,000 bail each. So there's an obvious massive issue with the judicial system and the magistrates, you know, the actual judges and the prosecutors. And I think that's where we need to be focusing a lot of attention.
There's a part of the book which describes a car chase involving a notorious chap named Big Joe. He was found with rhino horn in his car and a metal trunk at home containing about R5 million. He was arrested, jailed, and released on bail.
He was arrested the other day as well, a couple of months back. He's out on a R20,000 bail. He has got a long line and a whole freaking string of cases, including racketeering, murder, cash in transit, rhino poaching kingpin in South Africa, and he's out walking free. So there's an obvious problem, and I think that's the biggest problem in this country, is that there's no harsh sentencing, and these people are not being put in the cells and locked up and the key thrown away, which is what should be happening, that is not happening.
Yeah. You're doing your end of the work and they're not doing
theirs. That is the most frustrating thing to me, is we are aching and paining our asses out there and going like crazy, stopping these poachers and trying to keep that balance between destruction and preservation. And it's not the police, eh? The police they do their job. They process the crime scene, et cetera, et cetera. It's not the police's problem. It is the judicial system. It's the court. It's the judge, the corrupt judge that's sitting behind that table, who, when he brings down the hammer, saying, okay, you R2,000 bail. what happens with the transaction after that? Because these guys have made R1 million in the last month in poaching rhinos.
Precisely.
So, of course, the corrupt judge is going to want to get, okay, well, you're going to give me R200,000, just there you go. And this transaction will happen after the guy's paid his R2,000 bail to the court.
Shocking.
So
there you are, putting your life on the line every single time you go out. How can we help you?
Get the courts and the judicial system to get the act together. And there needs to be harsher sentencing, and there need to be less corrupt judges and court officials and prosecutors. That is probably the biggest reason why these rhinos have been decimated, because the poachers don't give a shit.
I left Conrad with a mix of strong emotions, rage that men like him have to do this dangerous work, but also hope that there are still people in South Africa who care enough to do it. On the way out, he showed us the life-size statue of a rhino he's constructed out of snares seized on patrol. Surrounding it are posts on which other snares have been hung. There are enough of them to make up at least one more statue. They've found something like 600 snares in the past 8 weeks alone. Conrad's mother wrote the epilogue to his marvelous book called By the Wild. In it, she says, "I have a son of Africa. This is the story of the small footprint he has left on the soil of Africa. One day the winds of time may wipe this footprint away, but I dare say his spirit will hover over the bushveld forever. Maktub, it is written." So that's it, the last Inspirations of 2024. I'm off to the Eastern Cape soon to collect stories for our January editions of Storycatcher. If you know of any that I should be collecting on the way to Grahamstown, on the way back, or indeed in that lovely area, please let me know. Meanwhile, I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.